Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host, as always. And today we are joined by John Lee. And John is the co-founder of PickFu, a powerful platform that helps businesses get instant feedback from their target audience. With a background in computer science from UC Berkeley and the University of Washington, John has worked at both tech giants like Microsoft and startups. He's passionate about helping businesses make smarter, data-driven decisions by giving them easy access to consumer insights. PickFu's quick polling system has empowered authors, game studios, and e-commerce sellers to refine their products and strategies. I've asked him to join us here today to share his story plus insights on both running a successful software company and turning market insights into dollars. So, John, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Daryl. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. And so before we hop into obviously PickFu and what you guys do, how did you even get started in business? Was this always the end goal? Do you come from a family of entrepreneurs and you knew from day one that eventually you were going to turn what you were doing into a business, or did you fall into it?
More of the latter than the former. My family, I don't come from a family of entrepreneurs. Although I would say that some of my relatives are entrepreneurial, but I don't think that they've done a lot of individual businesses per se. It all fell together. I think what sparked it was that in college at Berkeley, my co-founder and I, we graduated during the dot-com. We went to school during the dot-com boom and graduated at the dot-com bust. And so I think the intention, exactly, the timing was great, right? And so I think it was interesting to see our classmates go on to start their own startups, work at startups. We thought that was the path ahead of us, given that we were just about to graduate. And then the whole bust occurred. So we went to the safety of corporate jobs. But I think the idea had always been there in our heads in that experience to eventually try to start something together. And I think that sort of that idea of wanting to start something at some point was something that endured.
I love it. I love it. I love it. Do you feel that you really benefited from working in corporate? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but do you think that if you had just jumped into startups directly, would it have been more challenging?
I think there is a big benefit to actually working in corporate and having experience on what the other side of things, right? I feel like I was really fortunate to be able to work at Microsoft and to be at a company that was doing well, had proper processes and structure and so on. And obviously at the time when you're young and you just graduate and you're hungry to make things happen, all of that stuff, the bureaucracy, the process, the formalities, the titles, all of that stuff feels like a giant burden when it comes to trying to make something happen. And I was that type where it was very much like, why can't we just do this? Why can't we just do this? So you got to check with legal, you got to check with the product team, you got to check with all these other sort of gatekeepers. And it's easy to chafe against that and think that, okay, if we were solo, we could just do whatever we wanted. And you can. I think over time, I've realized that there's a certain level of process that's appropriate that helps things along. I feel like I've come to settle in the middle in between the two of just shooting from the hip versus having all kinds of red tape and bureaucracy and so on. And I think there's value in both.
So is it mostly about the processes? What do you feel is one of the biggest takeaways? Was it because he's saying that you feel like you're in the middle between obviously the typical stereotypical bloated corporate structure versus super lean but maybe more chaotic startup? You're in the middle, but were there other ways, like you say, being on the other side? How does that help you in terms of getting deals done?
So I think not so much in terms of getting deals done, because obviously when I was at Microsoft, I was the lowest on the totem pole. But I think seeing the way that software is built at a high level with very high standards was set a bar pretty well for me, set a good bar for me in terms of the mental model of what it means to build really good software and all the iteration and all the thought and evaluation and testing that needs to go into it, right? And I feel like that's something that helps me even to this day, even though we may or may not be having exactly the same standards that Microsoft has right now, because we have to move at a different pace and obviously times are different. But knowing that you can set the bar high and that there is benefit to building software the right way instead of just hacking things together haphazardly, I think that was a good lesson to learn there. And particularly, it was a good counterbalance when we went off on our own.
So can you, for people that maybe aren't as tech savvy, can you give an example? What's an example of hacking things together haphazardly versus the right? You're saying it's good to know the right, what is the right way to build software then?
Sure. I would draw the analogy of building a SaaS, like building a house, right? You can build a house really quickly. You can slam a bunch of 2x4s together and wood and whatnot, and you can have a shelter. And I think a lot of times, if you just want to get something done in software, there's a lot of different ways to do something similar where it just works. It's dirty. It ain't pretty underneath, but you got four walls and a roof over your head, right? And then if you like, or you can do it the other way where you're actually architecting and planning and making sure that the systems that you're putting in place and what you're designing are meant to last, can scale with the types of growth that you have in your wildest dreams, and also scale with the expansion of the set of the software that you intend in terms of your vision as you're building this thing over time.
Well, what would you recommend to someone who's starting out or even struggling? Do they slap something together for a minimum viable product, or do they build right from the get-go?
Oh no, I would definitely. I'm not here to preach the Microsoft way of building software. I think that if you're an entrepreneur and you're trying to build something, you get something together fast. But realize that what you're putting together, think about the next step after scaling. At some point, if things go well, you're going to need to scale. So just it's important to keep that in mind as you're putting your stuff together. And obviously, everything in business and everything about building is making trade-offs. So you just have to keep those trade-offs in mind.
Yeah, you're reminding me of the meme that I saw of this fisherman on a boat with a mermaid that's above water, and she's so pretty and big breasts, and he's like looking her in the eyes, like in love. And then there's the meme that has like front end for her, and then underwater is this massive behemoth dragon. It's like bad
Oh
day.
yeah, exactly. That's a pretty good meme. That's great.
Yeah. Okay. So get something together fast, but at some point you have to pivot at a startup. Into now we're going to build a real actual company. And when do you know it's that time? Is it when you feel you've got a scalable, repeatable method to onboard new clients? Is that when you feel you have product market fit, when you know why people are buying? Is that when you make the bigger investment in infrastructure or?
Yeah, I think product market fit is a journey, not a destination. I would say that even we're doing all right with our targeted customers, but we could still be doing better. And I think that journey of constantly refining, understanding who your target customers are, understanding their pain points, their experience, and deeply understanding what their goals are. That's something that you can always keep improving and honing, and then obviously improving your own offering to fit that better. I think the point of investing is an interesting, or your question about when is the time to invest, I think that's an interesting one. And I would say that when you start seeing some pretty promising traction, I think would be that point of, okay, you're starting to see a spark. You might as well try to add some kindling, might as well try to like get that fire a little bit bigger. And I know nowadays everyone's trying different side hustles and so on. And so it's really a judgment call of understand of where you think that there's traction, where you're seeing growth, where you're seeing your message resonate with maybe one niche of an audience that you've been trying to cultivate. No perfect answer there, right?
No, I love it. I think it's a great, honest answer. I've never heard it said that way, and I think it's great that product market fit is a journey, not a destination. I think that's a really accurate assessment. Now, where do most people go wrong? I know my opinions on this. I have to be careful, but where do most people go wrong, in product
I
market fit?
think you mean in terms of not finding product market fit?
Yeah, so they got a dream, they're cackling like mad scientists alone in their room. This is going to be great. The world's going to love it. Where do most people go wrong? But
I think it's the cackling like a mad scientist in your room that is probably the biggest tell that you may not be doing the right things to find that product market fit. If your ideas are grand and you're just in a room doing all this stuff by yourself and you're not making contact with the customer or your target customer early enough to get that market validation, you have no signal as to whether you're running in the right direction, right? Like all your efforts could be for nothing if what you think what the market wants is not actually what your market wants.
So how do you find that signal to noise? I love that you mentioned that. So what are signal indicators? What are signals?
Interest, basically, like even just as simple as putting out the idea to a forum, of who you think might be your target customers, or going to a trade show, talking to people who are in that industry that are your target customers, or talking to people that you know about that. Obviously, like the simple one is if you think that you're solving your own problem and then you feel that there's a market of similar people who have that same problem, then sure, then you can build for yourself. But if you're not your target market, then you need to go out there, put your idea out there, try to find your target market and get feedback from them. Obviously, feedback and validation. And obviously, the earlier you get that, try to get that feedback and validation, the better your chances are of either succeeding or at least reducing your chances of a complete failure.
I love that. So really following the interest.
Yes, following the interest and following the interests of your audience and your target customers.
What do you feel about, how do you feel about building in public?
I think building in public is a nice way of building an initial audience. I guess I would wonder, I think I would think carefully about who that audience is. I think if you're building in public, you tend to get a big supportive audience of other fellow entrepreneurs, people who want to start their own dream and look up to you in terms of sharing your journey and progress. I do not know how necessarily how well that does in terms of cultivating your target customer. So, depending on the angle of how you do it.
Can you elaborate some more? I love what I'm vibing with everything you're saying. So can you explain a little bit more for someone that, well, for me, let's just say for me.
Yeah, I think it's very noble to build in public, and I think you're able to build like a good community and make a lot of great connections there. But let's say you're building in public but you're building some kind of product for, I don't know, plastic surgeons. Something I'm totally not. So your story may or may not necessarily reach your target market. So I think it just depends on sort of your intent on what you're trying to get out of building in public, right? And I know that people who build in public, I follow some creators who do that. To me, it feels like it takes more than a little bit of time to build in public. So if you're siphoning some of your efforts towards being public about your building and that journey, then that's just a trade-off that you need to consider if doing that is not growing, if is not putting you in contact with your target customer and helping you find that product market fit.
I love that. I think that's a really important point. There's lots of people, like your mom will always love everything that you do, but will she buy it? And I think that that's,
Exactly.
you know, Gary Halbert, was a famous marketing expert of the past.
Copywriter, right? Yeah.
Yeah. He talked about he always would he had a pub he used to frequent, and when he was working on an important project, he would go down and he'd read his friends the sales letter. And if people were like, "That's great work, Gary," he knew it sucked and he had to go back and work on it. It wasn't until they were like, "Where? Who's selling this? Where do I get it?" That's when he knew he had a winner, when he would go down and read something and they wanted it for themselves. That's when he knew he had hit pay dirt.
Yeah.
And he said, for people to know and feel what that experience to get a tangible, if you've never had that, just post this. And this is still in the day of newspapers. He said, post this classified ad. A marketing superstar wants to sell your product for you for free. Message me and tell me about your thing, and I'll get you 100 plus orders for free. Just call this number or whatever, email, PO box. It's like, and when you get that pounding down your door, like it wasn't a pitch to like a client. So, and I've ruined the thing, but the basic concept is there, that he was like, if people want to understand what it's like to hit a home run, write that. And it, there's a difference between knowing, like I said this, because I've actually been working with Michael Gerber a lot recently, the author of E-Myth, and I've been helping him with a couple of his coaching programs fractionally. He's 88 and retiring, and I was talking to people that were considering doing something, and I was like, a lot of some of the stuff you might be able to look up in a book, but there's an intellectual experience, and then there's like a heart and soul felt experience. Like I can tell someone what it's like to climb Mount Fuji, but if you don't go and do it and have that experience and see the stars, like it's a totally, it's so easy to
Totally.
explain in words, but it's a different. And so that was kind of Gary Halbert's suggestion to know what it feels like when you've gotten hit a home run, is to put that out. And that's the proverbial, like the lineup is long for people that want someone else to make them rich, whereas the people willing to
Yeah.
work for it is minuscule. So it's,
Totally.
so now what do you feel, because you've been in business for a long time, what do you feel when you talk about product market fit as a journey, not a destination? What are some important skills and behaviors then that are really important to succeeding in that journey?
I think having an open mind. I think I've been in a number of different entrepreneur communities, and I think a pattern that I've seen a lot is that there's a subset of entrepreneurs that are very married to their own ideas. And rather than when they see that the market is not necessarily adopting their idea, they would rather reject the market and hold on to the idea rather than accepting the market and rejecting the idea. It depends what your goal is. If you're trying to be a missionary and you feel like you need this thing in the world, and you take it to this target market and they reject it, it's one of two things. Either they're wrong or you're wrong. If they're wrong, fine, then maybe you can pivot your thing to another market or something. But if you think that you're still wanting to serve this target market and they're telling you that this ain't it, then something's got to give. And I feel like I've seen that pattern a lot over the years of seeing entrepreneurs who are like, hey, I'm still working on this thing. And I'm still working on this thing. And I'm still trying to sell it into this niche, like still the same niche, not a different niche, same niche, same idea. So it makes me wonder what's actually changed then in terms of like their learnings, their capabilities, their understanding of the market. And so I see that pattern a lot.
Yeah, that's really powerful. I think it's important people to remember that problems are markets, not demographics. Explain it like if there's a lake on a mountain, that lake is maybe the problem. And around that lake, there's going to be birds, but there's going to be some birds that eat fish, some birds that eat insects and bugs, some birds that eat fruits and berries, some birds that eat other birds. They're all around that lake. And so, same thing if you think about problem, if we take in a like boredom, so they want to go see a movie. I need something to do, entertainment. That's a huge thing, right? I want something to do, entertainment. You look at the Super Bowl, it's one problem, it's one weekend event, and there's the person that steals the feed and streams it at home. There's the person who pays for the pay-per-view. There's the person that co-pays for it by going to the pub and they pay a fee to be at the pub and they buy some food. There's someone that drives down to the actual stadium and they get the cheap tickets and the nosebleed. This person wants to have their feet on the grass at the half, right? At the halfway mark. There's somebody that's in the big box still watching it on TV, even though they're in the stadium. I don't quite get that one. It's all the same thing. It's just different birds around the same lake, which is the problem. So I think that's a really powerful tip to give people. I just wanted them to make sure that they understood the value in what you said, that you really need to be clear on the problem that you're solving. And if the people that you're trying to sell it to don't feel that it's really that much of a problem, or they don't want to experience the solution in that way, then either you have to change your product or you have to change your who, your target market. I love that. So now, can we talk about that? We just mentioned before turning insights into dollars, into paychecks. How much can you trust the survey?
It depends on how you run it and the people who are taking it. And if both things, if you're running it well and the people who you are sending it to are high quality and relevant, then yeah, directionally, you can trust it quite a bit.
Now, what about, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. What about someone that would say Henry Ford said, if I asked people what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse?
That's true. That is true. And I think it takes some thought to run good surveys. I think what we try to do at PicFu, we're a polling panel, essentially, right? Like we provide access to millions of consumers around the world where you can come to PicFu and quickly poll your target audience. What we've tried to do is set up a whole bunch of different templates that match use cases for the different industries that we serve. We have a lot of users who come on, and they know that we're fast, that the responses are high quality, that it's super affordable, but they're still stuck at trying to figure out what the right question is. And so we've worked with enough companies in different industries to build industry-specific templates to help you get the right question, do the right targeting, and so on.
What are some examples of things that people, what are some of the highest value, highest impact polling that someone can do? Is it a green button versus red button?
No, not at all. I think so. We serve a number of different industries, but a big one that we do serve are entrepreneurs who sell on online, e-commerce entrepreneurs, and particularly people who sell on Amazon, a competitive marketplace like Amazon. So we service a lot of Amazon sellers. And the main thing that Amazon sellers know us for is being a very fast way of testing their main images. Because Amazon's a super competitive market, click-through rates matter a lot on those search results. And the other thing about that marketplace is that if you're shopping on Amazon, you're not shopping for, it's usually not by brand, right? You're not shopping for like Daryl's Daryl's beach cabana or something, you're shopping for beach cabana, like
Right.
typically. So if there's a lot less of brand loyalty, then it's really the images and the tech images and the copy and so on that matter a lot. So what we've seen is that using Pickfu to split test Amazon main images on Pickfu in under an hour with written feedback is a really good approximation for success on Amazon. That if you are winning, we just had an agency partner who does images and listings for Amazon sellers like all day. And she uses Pickfu for almost every project. And so she went back and through all of her dozens of pick polls for her clients, and she correlated that if you're winning in a Pickfu head-to-head poll, 75% of the time that you win on a Pickfu poll, you're getting more sales on Amazon. And we've seen sort of stuff like that over and over again. And we typically see click-through rate increases on Amazon of, let's say, 10 to 20% when people iterate and improve their images on Pickfu. So 10 to 20% increased click-through rate, depending on what you're starting from, could be quite a significant boost to your business, especially if that poll is only 50 to 100 bucks.
And you're saying that they give written feedback with their answers? That's something that you get.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the best way I could describe Pickfu is like it's like a digital focus group full of millions of global consumers who are ready to give feedback on your products and creative.
That is powerful. That is powerful. That is powerful. Now,
And every single, sorry, to add on to that, what you were saying about the written, yeah, is that every single person that you pull, it's not just about voting this or that or this or that or pick the best of eight things or something, but every single person needs to provide a detailed written response. And so it's those insights that really give you the idea of how to iterate on your creative. And we see that sort of iterative process of improving creative over and over again on our platform.
I think that's really powerful because I have a client who's trying to I have a client that I'm working with that has an existing business but wants to launch this new thing, and he's just been dancing around trying to make a page for this and that. And I told him just get a bunch of people on a call, a webinar, and
Yeah.
just talk to them. Just talk to them. And I had to confess to him, and I said, listen, I really don't want to confess this, but I've spent an obscenely more time, energy, and money than I want to admit. Driving clicks to pages to look at heat maps and stats and bounce rates and screen recordings, all this nonsense to figure out why they did or didn't do what I wanted them to do. Where if I had just asked them, if I had just put myself in between, I would know in 2 seconds. So the fact
Yeah.
that you get written feedback, I think, is incredibly valuable because there's all sorts of ways you can go and get a hundred, drop a wad of cash on the
Yep.
table and get a bunch of visitors. And it's almost like a particle collision. Like what happened? Let's look at the train
I
wreck,
know.
right? Some people went this way. Some people went that way. Something splattered on the wall over here. This thing didn't work, but you don't know. You just don't know. You're just,
Yeah, so why not ask them, right? And I think that that's another use of pick, like I said, it was a digital focus group, right? And so digital like focus groups, it's not just about comparing things. Like you can actually ask them their opinion on things. And so that what you just described, that use case is actually pretty common on Pickfu as well, where we have entrepreneurs who are putting in the links to their landing pages or the links to their Amazon products or the links to their e-commerce stores. And they're asking their target audience a question of check out this product or check out this website, review the page, and bring up any questions or objections that you might have from like a buyer perspective. And in under 30 minutes, you literally get like 50 to 100 written comments that are saying, oh, the price is either too high, or I'm not sure if this is eco-friendly, or I'm not sure if this site looks pretty scammy because there's no social proof on this. I don't know if the site can be trusted. There's a ton of stuff that you can get just by crowdsourcing feedback on your target landing pages. And that's not to demean, to take away anything from the paid approaches of driving a bunch of traffic and doing the particle collisions and exploring the heat maps and trying to understand the exact mouse behavior. There's a ton of value in that and studying the numbers, but there's also a ton of value in getting that qualitative feedback on your landing page or whatever it is that you're expecting to convert customers.
And how do you handle the drawbacks of a focus group? If it's a digital focus group, I know a story. I don't know if I'm just going on a tangent or what, but Glenn Livingston has been on the show a few times. He was the mentor, Ryan Levesque's mentor, that taught him about using market research. And I remember he tells a story once. They had done a focus group and went through all this rigmarole. And at the end, they said, "Thank you, everyone. Appreciate you being here today. Rebecca has your checks. You can go see her, get your payment at the end on your way out." And also, we just talked to the manager. They actually said you can take one of the products with you home. So just grab whatever you want off the table and go. And then all that whole rigmarole was actually to find out what they actually grabbed on the way out, because people will tell you what they're intellectually, but then it comes down to the actual reaction. So they told them like the colors and all this stuff. And they had them sit in the room. But at the end of the day, the real test was, "Hey, we've given you some money and you can actually pick whatever you want from any of the tables as you go home." What did everybody grab?
No, I think, yeah, I remember that story because I think that was about testing colors of Walkman, like the Sony Walkman
Oh,
or something.
okay.
Yeah, I think it was they were doing a focus group on the standard Walkman at the time. I think it was
Yeah.
in the 70s or something. Like everyone had a Walkman. That was like the coolest thing to have. And there was all standard black. And the team wanted to figure out like, hey, could we sell a yellow one? So they did that focus group where it was like, hey, we're gonna do a focus group, yellow, black, and the crowd's like, oh, yellow is so fancy, really likes, really stands out, all that stuff. And that's exactly what it was. Thank you for coming. And then at the end, you can walk out and hey, like you can take a product of your choice, and everyone grabbed the black, right? So yeah, it's not perfect. It's definitely not perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think nothing will ever be 100% correlative with your real world sales.
Of course.
But there's also, besides that, there's also this giant gap of just unknowns of like what you can also believe is that a more compelling logo, packaging that conveys better selling points about your product, a better designed and more compelling landing page, those are things that over the, in a broad sense, will impact your business. And I think that's a lot of stuff that like those things are things that I think digital focus groups like PicFu can actually help with. We've seen it with a lot.
100%. And even like I said, getting clarity, I've got my own, I guess, full transparency. I've got my own cold outreach that we do, campaigns. And we've got it down almost to science where we know, depending on how well the targeting is, how close an approximation we can get to our ideal target, what
Nice.
response we should have, ideally. Like we know, and I just spent a week in Singapore. And before we went, we added, I don't know how many contacts, but we added a bunch of contacts to it. And we got four high quality leads for our high ticket, like boom, like right off the bat. I was like, oh man, we need to go back and get some more of those people. So even just that respect, and then to the same effect, one of the calls I had with them, they're onboarding as a new client, but also I recorded the call with them and I went back to the team. And I said, "Hey, these were the things that they found most important. I think that actually we should bump this up on top of everything in terms of your not quite USP, but in terms of talking about features and benefits." And so I think, like we talked about the fitness group thing or the focus group, the pros and cons, that nothing's 100%. Written feedback, if it'll help you understand who is and isn't your demographic, it's better than sitting alone in a room thinking that you're going to launch something that
Yeah,
you're going to love.
exactly. Like that was actually the reason why we built it in the first place, is because we built it for ourselves because we needed unbiased feedback. So that was literally the origin story of PicFu.
And I think there's a benefit to it too, because if you're there in person, there's some social pressure to say nice things to you.
Friends. Like your mom, like your friends at the bar, right? They just get, they're biased and they don't want to say not nice
They don't
things
want to
to
make you
you.
cry.
Yeah. They don't
The
want to tell
bar
you
people
your
make you
baby.
cry and leave you
Yeah.
broke.
Yeah, they don't want to tell you that your baby is ugly, right? Like, understand.
Yeah, ugly baby syndrome. That's right. Yeah, no, I love it. But the market will leave you broke and crying
Oh,
and
yes.
cute. And so it's better to bleed and cry in training than on the battlefield. So pick. And now, how can you say you have my target market? Like, how do you know you can get 100 of my ideal clients to do this?
Depending on how targeted your clientele, like your consumer segment is. So we actually, I think at this point, we're about 18 million and counting on our panel size over 9 different countries, particularly in the US, but also a bunch of other countries. We actually work with existing third-party consumer panels, like the same consumer panels that actually big CPGs like Procter and Gamble or Mondelez, they use for their focus groups, and they tap into for their market research reports. So we're tapping into the same ones. It's just that typically those big guys, In corporate, there's an internal insights team that then works with a third-party market research consultant, and they put together these really big project plans, like determining the next smell or the next scent of this shampoo line. And there are these big projects, a lot of middlemen, and it takes months, weeks and months to execute. And at PicFu, we're basically trying to shortcut that entire process with software. Tap directly into those consumer panels, layer on a huge layer of targeting in terms of, we have over, I think, almost 100 different targeting traits. So it's not just your standard demographics, but if you're selling on Amazon, it's any major category in Amazon. If you're building a mobile game, it's every different game genre. If you're writing a book, it's all the different book genres. Like, you want to reach Kindle readers who own Android tablets, who have dogs, who there's just a whole bunch of mix and match targeting. So we're getting better and better every single day in our ability to target, and we're already able to target a lot.
And so what is the how many what is a considered a good, a small, medium, large test in terms of this has always been something that I've always had interest to hear people's answers. Some people say you need 20 answers. Some people say you need 100 answers. Some people say you need 500 answers. Where are you in that? Can I go on and the answers and be like, okay.
So on PicFu, it's a choose your own adventure, right? It's all self-serve, takes 2 to 3 minutes to set up a poll, and you can choose between 15 to 500 people in your target audience, like that match your target audience. Now, people will say, oh, 15 people, like that's, I read market research surveys, and they said that they surveyed 1,000 people and so on. But going back to what I was saying about that traditional market research process, one of the big jobs of those third-party market research consultants is actually filtering out bad answers, like filtering out bad respondents. They say that they'll survey 1,000 people, but out of those 1,000 people, maybe only 400 were actually paying attention. 600 were probably just straight lining down the survey or writing in gibberish just because they were trying to get a treat at the other end, just fill out the survey to get some kind of thing. So in traditional market research, much of the time and effort is spent filtering out bad responses and only returning like a handful of those 1,000 that are actually quality. With PicFu, we filter out all that already. So the 15 that you get have already been pre-filtered. We have all kinds of software going on to make sure that people are paying attention, people are answering the question that you're asking them, and they're not just writing gibberish or like copying and pasting or doing whatever. And for that reason, almost with every PicFu poll, if you ask for, let's say, 50 responses, we've probably rejected over 50 people, 50 other people who've already tried to answer that survey and don't meet our quality bar.
I love that. I love that. I love that. That sounds really powerful. So, where do you see the future of your industry going? If we fast track 5, 10 years down the road, there's a lot happening geopolitically. There's a lot happening in terms of technology coming out. What's your crystal ball? What are you looking at?
If only I had a crystal ball. I think a lot of things are changing, but things that won't ever change are ease of use, a recognition of high quality insights, speed, and providing a whole lot of value to your users. I don't think any of that changes. Obviously, the tools with AI, with mobile, with crypto, even like the amount of technologies and like geo changes and so on are crazy. But I think there's always going to be businesses who need fast, reliable feedback from their target audience to make better business decisions. So that's our North Star, and that's always where we're going to be focused. And in terms of the landscape of technologies, things that are available, trends, all that stuff, those are all just tools and opportunities that can help us to get there.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I agree. Business is about doing, what does it say? All the companies is a group of people serving another group of people, and they do
Exactly.
solving the problem of another group of people, and they do it via a product or service. And unless the robots are going to start paying us for stuff, we're still at the end of the day going to have to be appealing to other humans on the other side of things. So
Exactly.
that's, yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. I you didn't ask, but it's my podcast, so whatever.
You can say whatever you
Yes, that's right.
want.
That's right. No, I'm kidding. But I think that everything's been a tool. I think that AI is overhyped in the sense of I think it's a very powerful tool. I don't know if we're going to create a new sentient being. I'm not 100% sure on that. I think it's very dangerous. I think because of the power that it has, if it was a seek and destroy,
Agreed.
if it had seek and destroy programming, it could be incredibly dangerous in military applications. But at the end of the day, I think it's still really just a tool. when we've been building tools, they said that the farmers are going to be replaced when tractors came out. We still need farmers. There's a lot of automation, but we still have a lot of farmers.
Exactly.
He said that we wouldn't need bookkeepers and accountants when calculators came out. We still need them.
Got
Sheet, same thing. We can replace a whole accounting department with a spreadsheet. QuickBooks, still have accounting firms. So I just don't necessarily buy that we're all going to be. I think that people will need to upskill. Sure. I think it's not as many of us are spending our days digging for coal, but I just don't think that unless there's a spark of life. I was really surprised to learn this. That when the sperm meets the egg, there's an actual flash of light. The scientists think it's a release of zinc. That's what they say. It looks like a release of zinc. But I grew up in a house of hard science, geology and physics. But we can't replicate that. That's great. You think it's a flash of zinc. Can you flash zinc and have a sentient being come out? I don't know what that is. We can't until we figure that part out.
Not there yet.
I just don't think we're gonna have I think we can fool ourselves. I think we can create AI that fools of David Deutsch, who's the godfather of quantum computing, was saying until we can explain the specific process through which we create, because a lot of AI properties are emergent, meaning that you can't clearly articulate how many bubbles or project how many bubbles are going to happen in a kettle of water and where they're going to go, and you can't do that. But the emergent property is my water is hot and boiling, and so a lot of the things that are happening in AI are emergent, and we don't know specifically how they're happening, and so we can't quite really say what it is. And I, anyway, so maybe there is a room for the miracle of life, but until the our spark of life, until as an entire species, all of us just decide to keel over, we're gonna want to drive the bus, and the bus is a tool, and that's it. That's the beginning, the middle, the end. That's it. I think that's you just learn the tools, so the tools don't learn you, right? I think that's a really powerful place to be. Now, what do you feel have been some of the most important habits that have helped you on your path to success and in growing your company?
I think, sorry, say that I interrupted you. That was
No,
the
I
last
just
part.
daily, I'm verbose. Daily, weekly habit kind of thing.
Being curious and always learning, I think
Is
that
that a
is.
habit? So does that mean that you read every day? Or does that mean you read every week? What is that? Can you turn it into a habit?
A habit for me is staying on top, trying to stay on top of the latest tools and trends in the industry. I think that it's valuable, even to the point where I think we were talking before we started recording. My co-founder and I, we went to a conference recently where we were not typical for the attendee because the attendee was a very large, this is a SaaS conference, but it wasn't like a small SaaS conference. It's a very big SaaS conference, and we are not a very big SaaS. We don't have a very huge team. We don't have all that VC fund, like all that backing that a lot of those other attendees did. But the point is to learn, right? The point is to understand what other people are doing, best practices in other domains, best practices in other disciplines, and just constantly trying to absorb everything that I can and filter it through my lens of what we're trying to do at PicFu. And I think that helps. I think that helps keep us aware of the opportunities. I try to read a lot about team building and culture building and trying to put together teams that actually are both happy and productive. Jury's still out on all of that, right? But I think it's important that once your business scales beyond just you or just you and a co-founder, and there's other people involved. And as a founder, you have an obligation to the people in your company. And we feel that very deeply. Like it's important that you have a good team, that you select very carefully who comes on your team. And then once they're on your team, that you make sure that it's about the team because the team is now trying to work towards that vision, and it's not just you and a co-founder necessarily by yourselves anymore.
I love that. I love that. Yeah, I agree. Greg Glassman, the founder of CrossFit, had this talk I thought was great, where he talked about how markets are ultimately unknown and unknowable. And I'm paraphrasing here. If I ask you how many people are in market for a car today, there's indicators. You can look at keyword searches and foot traffic. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we don't truly know the true number, and it's constantly in flux. So it's unknown and unknowable. But everyone can acknowledge and recognize excellence. And that kind of, and so by pursuing excellence in solving the problem you solve, that can be a great North Star and guiding light, which goes back to what you said about ease of use, speed, high quality, high value to the users. It's just focusing on having it be an excellent user experience that delivers an excellent end result to solve a specific problem, a specific type of problem for a specific type of person. And I think that's a really powerful statement and a great guiding light to help people try to as they navigate through all the tech changes and all this sort of stuff. John, this has been a great interview. Is there anything I haven't asked you that I should have asked you?
I don't think so. I'll add one thing towards what you were saying about the Spark and about the AI and everything, because I think that that was a really interesting topic. And one thing that people have asked me as well in terms of using AI. And I think the best thing I heard about it is that AI is not going to replace people. Sorry, let me rephrase that. AI is not going to take your job. It's people who know how to use AI who are going to take your job.
I think that's really true. John, if people want to learn more, if they want to get involved, if they want to run their own polls, what are some of the best ways for them to reach out, get in touch, to follow?
For sure. Yeah. So PicFu is self-service, do it yourself. You can sign up for free. It costs $1 per person. So costs are very affordable, scales as you want. So anyone who is really looking to have an easy way to get feedback from your target market, you can go straight to PicFu, create an account, and start polling right now. I'm generally not too active on social, but I am active, somewhat active on LinkedIn. So you can find me on LinkedIn to connect. Happy to chat there.
Yeah, okay. So go check out picfu.com, right? Let me make sure I
Yep,
get that right.
PICKFU.com. Yep.
PICKFU.com. Go
That's
sign up, try the free account, test it. If you're in business, I don't know how you could lose. I don't really have any dog in this fight. I'm not getting referral fees or anything, but I just think that all of us need better insight and feedback. If you do anybody that does paid advertising, you're gonna pay $1 a click pretty much on any platform. So to pay $1 per response is a phenomenal deal. You can go look up John Lee on LinkedIn, JOHNLI. Of course, you got the right one if he's with PicFu and in San Francisco Bay Area. So, John, thank you so much for joining us. It has been an honor and a pleasure knowing that you got your own community, your own direct reports, your own people to talk to. Thank you for coming and sharing with my community and I so we can all perform a little bit better.
Much appreciated. It's been a pleasure to chat with you, Daryl.